Humans are social animals, we're often told. We like to hang together in groups, most of us, and the things we do are heavily influenced by what the group is doing. In short, we respond to peer pressure. Oh, do we respond to peer pressure, which can often be a good thing, and that is how our guest this hour proposes to use it. Robert H. Frank suggests peer pressure can work on the issue of climate change the way it once worked with smoking. He's the author of the book Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Robert H. Frank teaches at Cornell University, where he's professor of management and professor of economics. His writing includes columns for the New York Times in the Economic View section and several previous books. Robert Frank, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff.
I have to. It was good to have you. So the term behavioral contagion is new to me, but it's kind of a descriptive term and a fun one.
Yeah, I think social scientists have been onto this for a while. Ideas and behaviors can really spread through populations, just like infectious diseases do. And I think you mentioned the term peer pressure. It was one I was determined shouldn't appear in the title or subtitle or marketing materials for my book because it has such a negative connotation.
Sure.
On balance. It was only when my editor proposed calling the subtitle Putting Peer Pressure to Work, I thought, that has a kind of a man bites dog sound to it. Maybe that will intrigue people since it cuts against that negative impression. And I think it's certainly true. Peer pressure causes enormous difficulty for us, but the other side of that coin is it can do an enormous amount of good if we harness it.
Now, one of the examples you give is about how we buy heavier cars. That you think is a result of peer pressure, and what's the overall effect?
You know, I think this was a mystery to the engineers who designed the SUV. They thought it would be a niche product, but then it exploded. It's now by far the biggest selling category of vehicle sold. And they thought, well, what's the point of this vehicle? People don't really need to tow boats up into the mountains, most of them. They don't haul a lot of stuff. They say they want to go off-road. They need an off-road vehicle. The only time they go off-road is when they miss their driveway on a Saturday night. So why do they need these things? They were puzzled. But they did become fashionable. And when others had heavier vehicles and you didn't, then there was, of course, the threat of being squished by one. You had an incentive rationally to buy a bigger one yourself, and then others bought bigger still, and there was a cascade upward. So now we have these 7,000-pound behemoths all around us, and you know, that's neither desirable nor necessary. I mean, people who need big vehicles like that, and there are always people who did, fine, they should drive them, but if we taxed vehicles by weight, we need to tax something. After all, so why not tax things that cause harm to others? If you drive a 7,000-pound vehicle, you put others at risk. You make others more likely to buy a vehicle like that, and that puts even more people at risk. Why not contribute something to offset the costs you're imposing on others? And if we did that, then the people who don't need big vehicles would say to themselves, what's the point here? I'm going to buy a Honda sedan, and we'd see that cascade go operating in reverse. And at the same time, we'd be collecting revenue that we could use to offset the payroll tax. The payroll tax is a silly tax insofar as it's a useful thing when companies hire workers. Why would we want to discourage that? We should tax only those things that cause harm to others.
So you're basically talking about flipping some switches, pulling some levers to make peer pressure or behavioral contagion work in favor of society and the planet. So you're really talking about doing this to help slow climate change.
That's probably the very most important application of the ideas in the book. You know, we buy heavier vehicles, we build bigger houses, we go to destination weddings, we do all these things that use a lot of energy to no obvious effect, and we do them not just because we're not charged for the carbon we emit into the atmosphere. That's part of the problem. The main reason we do these things is that other people like us do them, and the one clear finding in the very contentious and huge literature on the determinants of human well-being is that beyond a certain point, when the houses get still bigger for everyone, nobody gets any happier at all. That money not only wastes energy, it's just a waste of money. People would be just as happy with 10,000 square foot mansions as they were with 20,000 square foot mansions. Probably happier, since the bigger properties are a nuisance to manage.
Yeah, maintenance and cleaning and all that stuff. Now, you come back to smoking many times in the book, and tell us you'll come back to it many times early in the book as an example of what?
You know, I think that's the easiest case study to see both the nature of the problem, how peer pressure can lead us down a path we'd rather not go down, and how we might gently change people's incentives to reverse that effect. The smoking habit is one that you'll never hear a parent say, "I hope my kids grow up to be smokers." Why do people smoke? We've known for a long time it's bad. The main reason people smoke is that others around them smoke. So if you're worried that your teenage daughter might become a smoker, it's not going to tell you anything about the risk of that happening if you know that she's, say, a science fiction buff. That doesn't, if she likes math, that doesn't tell you anything. If she's a sports fan, no information there either. The one thing that will predict her risk of becoming a smoker is the proportion of her friends who smoke. And it's a big effect. If that number goes from 20 to 30%, for example, she will be 25% more likely to become or remain a smoker. There's no other effect remotely that big. We've always known that social circumstances influence what we do. It's I think, been known, too, that social circumstances are themselves a consequence of what we do. So I would rather raise my kids in an environment where there are few smokers. How many smokers are there? That's a consequence of how many of us choose to smoke. And yet I rarely meet anybody who would say, I was thinking of smoking but decided not to because I was concerned that I might make others more likely to smoke. But that is an effect. And the astonishing thing to me is that it's so easy to push people gently against a tendency to smoke.
So back to the smoking example, we just put enough disincentives in there and convinced enough people to stop smoking that it kind of snowballed in a sense, didn't it?
It did. And we know that when it gets more expensive to smoke, which it did because of the taxes we imposed on cigarettes, and when it gets less convenient to do it, which it did because of the various bans and regulations we impose, people are less likely to start smoking, but the effect is fairly small of that. Smoking is incredibly difficult to quit once you've started. A friend was a heroin addict years ago. He told me that it was way harder to quit smoking than it had been to quit heroin. We would never have seen the 70% reduction in smoking rates that we've seen in the last couple of decades had it not been for the contagion effect, multiplying the effect of those changes in small incentives, taxes, and regulations. So we know that just a gentle push, making it a little more expensive, making it a little less convenient, can get a cascade that had been in the past making more people smoke. We could push that in the opposite direction. And nobody I've ever met has said, "Oh, I'm sorry that the environment now has so few smokers in it." That's an unalloyed benefit for parents who are hoping to raise their kids to be healthy adults.
I wonder then, just as an aside, because you don't mention it in the book, what you make of the mushrooming of the practice of vaping, particularly among young people.
It's a very troubling development. The data we've seen suggests that it's even more highly contagious than smoking. We don't know yet how serious the health consequences of it are. There is reasonably good evidence suggesting that it's less serious than smoking. So I think public health officials thought that if people would switch from smoking to vaping, that would on balance be a good thing. But what we're seeing instead is people who would not have smoked are suddenly taking up vaping because that's what their friends are doing. And so I think this is an area that's ripe for investigation. You know, what are the hazards? What ought we to be doing about that?
All right. So smoking aside, you, and again, the smoking meme comes up again and again in the book, Under the Influence. But you also write of the mother of all cognitive illusions. What is that?
So if we're going to decarbonize the economy, that's going to be an enormously expensive undertaking. It's going to be a mobilization on the scale of what we had to do during World War II, and that's daunting when people think about it. In fact, there's an enormous amount of money in the economy that's now being put to absolutely no good purpose. There's a big literature on the determinants of human well-being. It's contentious. There's hardly any agreement on anything in it. But the one clear finding in that literature is that once houses get beyond a certain size, once cars get there, there's absolutely no gain when they get bigger still. The people who live in the big houses wouldn't be happier if they got 50% bigger. They'd be less happy just because it's a nuisance to live in such big houses and manage them. And if we had a slight change in tax policy, we could harvest the roughly $2 or $3 trillion a year that are being wasted in runaway consumption arms races of that sort and put to use decarbonizing the planet, which is probably job one if we want to have a viable environment for our kids and grandkids. The resistance to that is from people who would have to be taxed. We're not going to tax poor people to get that money. We're going to have to tax people who already have a lot of money. They're not worried, I don't think, that they won't be able to buy what they need. Of course, they'll be able to do that. What are they worried about? Oh, we won't be able to buy the special extras we want. And here's where the illusion comes in. Special extras, what are they, like the apartment with a sweeping view? There are only so many sites that command that. How do you get them? You have to outbid other people like you who also want them. And when you think about the factors that determines who will be the high bidder, there's really only one thing that matters: how much relative spending power do you have? And here's the key point. When your taxes go up and the taxes of people like you go up, your relative bidding power doesn't change one iota. So the same apartments with the same 360-degree views of the ocean or the, or like, I guess you can't have a 360-degree view of the
it's only a small island.
Yeah. There are only a few places where you can have that. But a sweeping view of the city, there are only so many of those, and they're going to end up in exactly the same hands as before. People don't realize that. It would be not natural for them to realize that. The way you would normally think about how taxes would affect you is to think back to the last time they went up. How did I feel then? But that doesn't work, because if you're alive today, your taxes have not gone up. They've gone down steadily since World War II. So what do you do instead? You try to estimate the effect of higher taxes by trying to remember the last time you had less money, because, you know, taxes going up means you'll have less money to spend. And you might have had a business reverse, a divorce, a home fire. There are things that cause you to have less money. And each one of those has a bad memory stitched into it. And what you know is you don't want to have that to happen. But what's true about events like that is that they cause you to have less money, but they have no effect on the incomes of others. So you really are less able to bid for the things you want when those things happen. But that's not what happens when your taxes go up. And that's been such a barrier to us making the public investments we need to make to restore our infrastructure and build a green energy economy that we just haven't been able to make progress, because the people at the top have acquired the power to resist the taxes necessary to pay for all that for no good reason. They think it's going to hurt them if they contribute to that effort. It will not hurt them.
Because they have so much money already?
No, because if they are taxed more heavily to pay for those things, it won't affect their relative bidding power at all.
All right, so they'll still get the good places, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They'll still get the special extras that they were hoping to get.
Robert Frank, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Now, context looms large in the book, huge even. And you get into seven general premises that form your argument in the book. And I want to get into number four. This is that context shapes our choices, but our choices also shape context.
So how big a house do I need? The question really depends on the social context that you inhabit. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal long ago. I lived in a two-room house. It had no electricity, no running water. That house never for one instant seemed in any way unsatisfactory to me when I was living in it. I had colleagues and friends over routinely. It was a nice place to gather. If I lived in that same house in Northern California or Southern Oregon, my kids would not have wanted their friends to know where we lived. They would have been ashamed. I would have been ashamed. The same house in that other context would be grossly unsatisfactory. It would be a statement to the world that I had failed to meet even my most minimal obligations to myself and my family. So, yeah, the context determines what we feel we need, and when we spend money that we have that we didn't expect to have, that's what's been happening for now 40 years at the top of the income ladder, where all the income growth has been going. Those people are behaving normally. They're doing what poor people do, what middle-income people do. When they get more money, they build bigger. And when they build bigger, they shift the context that shapes what other people like them feel they need to spend. Maybe now it's the custom to have your daughter's wedding reception at home rather than a country club or hotel. So we need a ballroom. We build bigger. And then the group just below that group socializes with them. They now feel they need to have a dining room that will seat 18, not just 12. So they build bigger. And without invoking that kind of cascade, which goes all the way down the income ladder, you can't explain why the median new house is more than 50% bigger than its counterpart from 1980. It's just not explainable by income changes or cost changes. It's all because people like them are building bigger, and the reason people like them are building bigger is that people above them are building bigger, and it traces all the way to the top, where the ultimate reason is that they have more money. And all of that is for naught. People would be just as happy if that cascade had never happened, and would be indeed way more happier and healthier if the same dollars had been spent on things that we know would be of value to people.
Let me come back to the seven premises that form the core of your argument. You say six and seven are particularly controversial. Number six is to encourage good choices, discourage bad ones. That seems straightforward, you know, don't smoke rather than smoke. Number seven, though, is taxation is better than regulation. Explain that, please.
You know, it sounds controversial, but on reflection, I don't think it should be. Nobody likes taxes. Some people say all taxation is theft. We shouldn't have any. Those people aren't really serious participants in any discussion of taxation, because if you didn't have taxes, you wouldn't have a government at all. Good, some of them would say, but then if you didn't have a government, you wouldn't have an army. You'd be invaded by a neighboring government that had an army, and then you'd pay mandatory taxes to that government. So it's just not an interesting question to say we shouldn't tax anything. The only interesting questions in that domain are what should we tax and at what rates? The second question is hard. It's really a philosophical question about the scope and scale of government. The question of what we should tax ought to be completely uncontroversial. We ought to tax behaviors that cause undue harm to others. Emitting CO2 into the atmosphere is causing enormous harm to ourselves and the planet. We should be charging people for doing that. We don't do that now. We should be. We should charge people for smoking, not because secondhand smoke causes injury. It does, but those injuries are very small, not nearly enough to justify the high taxes we've imposed. The real harm you do if you smoke is you make other people more likely to smoke. That's the harm you cause, and that's a perfectly legitimate reason for levying a fee on you. And the reason that should be uncontroversial is that if we collect a tax on a harmful activity, that means we can reduce some other tax on a useful activity. We tax payrolls now, for example. Mm-hmm. Why should we be taxing payrolls? That discourages firms from hiring workers. So taxing cigarettes an extra dollar means we can lower the payroll tax by a dollar. Why wouldn't that be a good thing? And then finally, the attraction of a tax rather than a ban or a stiff prescriptive regulation is that if you really care about the activity, you can still do it. We're not telling you can't do it. We're just saying that if you do it, you'll be causing harm to others, and you ought to make a contribution to the community to help offset that harm and to discourage others from causing similar harm. Yeah, I think taxes are way more negative in people's minds than they would be if we taxed the right things and had an intelligent discussion about why it makes sense to do that.
Robert H. Frank is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of management and professor of economics at Cornell University in New York State. His book is Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work, in which he says we should put peer pressure to work to help steer climate change in the direction we want it to go. 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join us by phone, send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Morning, Robert. Well,
good
I have
morning,
a
Jamie.
Comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think that the comment, I think it's extremely ironic that Dwight D. Eisenhower invented the national freeway system, so to speak, so that we could move heavy equipment from one side of the country to the other mm-hmm. as a defense measure. And now our cars are becoming like tanks. sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy here.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's my comment. My question is, did you ever cover Barack Obama's Cash for Clunkers plan, in which he was basically giving people an incentive to lose their more polluting cars and then hopefully buy a less polluting car? And I'll take the edge.
Yes, I did. In fact, I did write about that, and it was a terrific idea, in my opinion.
All right, so was that the kind of peer pressure you talk about, to make sure that you can give people financial incentives to stop doing the old thing and start doing the new thing?
Yeah, that wasn't as direct an application of the ideas in this book, but mm-hmm. What we know is that in places like L.A., most of the pollution that still exists there comes from old cars, and the reason that's so is that we exempted old cars from the pollution requirements. Because we thought it would be too big a burden on the mostly low-income people who drive old cars. To meet the emissions standards, we then had to make the requirements on new cars so much stricter, and by then we'd already picked the low-hanging fruit, so we had to spend an enormous amount of money to get the last little bits of pollution out of the new cars. It would have been much cheaper to give every poor person, a low-income person, a five-year-old Honda Civic, and say, here, drive this, and we're going to require all cars to meet the emission standards. Yeah, it was a great move, and we ought to do more moves like that.
All right, so let's talk about where we think our behavior is independent, but where there's behavioral contagion. And the example you give is of people remember the name Alan Funt past a certain age because he was the host of Candid Camera, but he did a film that was a bit more risque than that. And talk about the job applicant in the room.
Yeah, I like that example. If somebody asks me what's the most vivid example of peer influence you can cite, I think that's one that always springs to my mind. It's a fake interview. He posts an ad for a job that sounds unbelievably good. Lots of people sign up. They want to have this job. It pays well. It doesn't have any burdensome requirements. So a candidate comes for his interview. He's shown into the waiting room. There are already four people waiting quietly. He doesn't know it, but those four are working for Funt. They're Confederates of his. They keep coming back to the scene. Nothing's happening. They just sit there. Finally, they come back. There's a close-up of the subject's face. He's impassive, but then suddenly he looks very startled and agitated. The camera pans out, and we see that the reason for that is that the others have at no apparent signal stood up and have started taking off their clothing. And he looks more and more fretful watching the scene unfold, and then finally you can see him flip. He stands up and he takes off his own clothing. The scene ends. All five of them are standing there naked. What comes next? They wonder, or he wonders anyway. And you know, I saw that and thought to myself, no way I would do that. But you have to think about it from the perspective of the subject. You know, it was a great job. The others were there before he was. Maybe they know something. He knows he doesn't know anything. They think it's worth getting up and taking off their clothes as the next step in the process. Maybe it is. And so he does it too. I still don't think I would have done it, but you can't really find fault with him. You know, it's a complex world. We don't know what to do much of the time. And other people don't know either often, but collectively they know more than any one of us does. And so if you see people acting confidently in a certain way, maybe they know something. So you maybe ought to at least investigate whether you ought to be doing it.
The term fashion keeps getting into the conversation. There's a great story that Abraham Lincoln tells about, you know, what would happen if a man wore a hat to church, a woman's hat to church, that sort of thing. But it brings us to the question of, do we don political positions like gay marriage or fierce opposition to sexual misbehavior in the workplace and legal pot the way we once donned bell bottoms?
You know, those things are each and every one of them very heavily influenced by fashion. And again, it's partly just a consequence of the fact that the world is complicated and there's just not time or energy enough to become well informed about everything. And so taking cues from others is really not only sensible, but inevitable. So think about the debate that once raged about whether slavery was an acceptable practice. It was a very longstanding and heated debate. That debate has long since been settled in the public mind. If you would query a college student today, they probably couldn't give you any of the detailed arguments on either side of that debate. They're vehemently against slavery. Why are they? Because everybody they know is vehemently against slavery. And the fact that they can't give you a detailed account of the particulars of the debate is lamentable, maybe in one sense, but that frees up time to devote to other things that are quite pressing in the current environment. So we just can't do everything on our own. We've got to take cues from others. If somebody installs solar panels on his rooftop in my neighborhood, it's quite reasonable for me to imagine that he must have run the numbers and decided that it wasn't a crazy idea to do that. And so at the very least, I ought to be motivated by the sight of his panels to have a conversation with him and ask him about it or go online and investigate what's the payback period here if I do that. So yes, of course we're influenced by these things. And on balance, if you didn't have any impulse to be influenced by what others were doing, you'd be ill-equipped to survive in the world. Of course, you've got to be judicious. We hold you responsible not to copy stupid things that your peers do. Every parent struggles to impart that message to his or her kids. So yeah, it's a fine line that we have to walk, but the presumption that peer influence is per se a negative thing, I think, is wrongheaded.
Well, that's a great example you gave, though, about solar panels, because as you point out, we get into things like positional arms races, which you advise us not to call keeping up with the Joneses, but that's the essence of it, that we want the stuff that other people around us have, which leads us to expenditure cascades, where we end up spending more and more getting, as we talked about already, the bigger cars, the bigger houses. But with the things like solar panels, though, and there are efforts already underway to try to make sure that people are aware of this. Tell us about Project Sunroof.
Yeah, it's a great website that Google runs. You can put in your address. They will show you aerial photos of your neighborhood. And on the rooftops of the houses, you'll see some have solar panels, others don't. The ones with them have red dots on them, so you can see them more easily. And there's a striking feature to these photos. The houses that have red dots on them are almost always next to or across the street from another house that has one. The houses that don't have red dots are similarly clustered. They're next to houses that don't have them either. So the studies of solar installation have identified it as one of the very most contagious of all activities. It's informationally contagious. It's sort of morally contagious. You want to be seen by others as an environmentally responsible person. That's a status you have to earn. You have to be relatively environmentally responsible. So if others have panels and you don't, then you're an environmental slacker. And so there's a multiplicity of motives that get people to follow their peers in this domain, and that's by and large been a hugely beneficial thing. You know, we've tried to even accelerate the process by subsidizing the early adopters. Some have complained, oh, that's a bad idea because mostly it's the upper income people who are the first to take advantage of the subsidies. Yes, that's true, but the contagion that results from those subsidies is enormously valuable. It helps drive down the cost curve. Now solar in many places is about to become cheaper than using existing gas and other fossil fuel sources of electricity. And once that happens, there's no issue of how you get your power. You're gonna choose the cheaper method, and we'll be on a stampede to do renewables.
Okay, so now other examples that you have that indicate or look at how people use energy or consume it. The energy conservation messages delivered to San Diego homes. You tell this story in the book. What happened there?
Many utilities now tell you how your energy use compares with your neighbors. And if you're more frugal, people seem to like that. If you're using way more energy than your neighbors, people don't like that. And that's the one prompt that gets people to economize more than any other measure that the utilities have discovered to take. So it's a very effective measure. It was pioneered after early research showing that in hotel rooms, when they try to get you to reuse your towel, saying it would be a good thing to do doesn't help. Telling people that 60% of the people who occupied this room recycled their towels, put them up not to be washed for the next day, was way more effective than just saying it would be a good thing.
Okay, so these are interesting efforts but Project Sunroof, as you mentioned, is from Google. It's the utilities who are doing the energy conservation messages or the hotels in the most recent case. But then, how do you turn this into policy, though? I mean, and does it need to come from a government level? You again already said that you'd rather do taxation more effective than regulation. So this gets us into Arthur Pigou and Pigouvian taxes. What are they?
The Democrats and the Republicans in the public policy sphere are almost unanimously agreed that if you have pollution, smoke or toxic emissions or noise or congestion, standard negative externalities. A.C. Pigou, a British economist writing in 1920, said that the best thing to do in response to those problems is to charge people for the behaviors that give rise to them. It's called Pigouvian taxation. There's a Pigou club that has lots of prominent people in it. Grover Norquist is a member of it, and Paul Krugman is also a member of it. I don't think there's any club on earth that has a more extreme span of the political spectrum than the Pigou club. Everybody agrees taxing pollution is the right way to go. And so if you think about the carbon emissions problem, that's a standard pollution problem. But most of these other things in the energy use domain are behavioral externalities, not smoke or noise or congestion. They're things we do that cause the behavior of others to change in negative ways. And the exact same arguments that Pigou used for taxing pollution and other standard externalities apply equally to taxing behavioral externalities. We ought to be taxing a lot of these behaviors that cause harm to others. The other point of the argument is that because our expenditure patterns are wasteful in exactly the same way it's wasteful when we all stand up to see better and nobody sees any better than if we'd all remain comfortably seated, we would like an incentive not to stand in those cases. And we can use tax policy in very simple ways to get us to steer those same dollars we would have spent on mine is bigger positional arms races to instead invest in decarbonizing the economy, which is something we desperately need to do and we're running out of time to do.
There's something you just sort of lay off to the side here in the book, though, which is you said that France could have avoided the yellow vest protests, which have disrupted so much of just daily life in France for quite a long time now. France could have avoided the protest with better designed taxes. How would you have designed them to in the hope of having those off.
And it's not just France. It's many jurisdictions have tried to impose carbon fees, and they've faced enormous pushback. People don't like it. They say it's too big a burden for low and middle income families who are indeed struggling economically for reasons we talked about earlier. You should make a carbon fee system revenue neutral. And all that means is you collect the revenue from the carbon fees. You charge people according to the carbon content of the things they consume. You take that revenue and then you give it back to people. In my preferred arrangement, you give it back only to middle and low income families. And since the upper income families worldwide, 10% of at the top of the income ladder use almost 50% of the total energy, most of the revenue from a carbon fee would come from the wealthy. If you give it back in equal monthly rebate checks to all middle and low income families, you could design a scheme where 90% of all voters would get more money each month back from the measure than they would pay in carbon taxes. So you could sell that kind of measure politically without any trouble at all. And so I think it's really political malpractice that they didn't have the wit in these various jurisdictions to make it revenue neutral. The main thing is to get the tax or the fee on the books.
So the point then again is not to take in any more money. It's just to make sure that you're taxing the behaviors you want to limit.
Right. And we, at the same time, we do need more money to invest in green energy, but that's not the place to get it. We want everybody to pay a carbon tax. We don't want to discourage the imposition of that program by having low and middle income people. So the money we need for investment in green energy has got to come from the people at the top of the income pyramid. It's not going to come from the poor. You rob banks because that's where the money is. The people at the top can afford to pay more for those investments. They'll benefit enormously from them. And as we discussed earlier, they won't have to make any sacrifices at all in order to respond to those additional levies. So there's really no good reason not to do it.
Robert, we have an interesting email from Anna in Medford who writes, my sister-in-law has started to receive that information from her utility, comparing her resource use to her neighbor's. In her case, it turns out she's been using much less than most people around her, which has actually had the effect of giving her permission to keep her house warmer, take longer showers, etc. Can you speak to that phenomenon? Thanks,
well,
Anna.
There must be cases like that. Yeah, and that's that's not the intention of the program. What we know overall is that the people who get messages like her sister got reduce their energy use a little bit on balance. That must mean that some reduce it more and others even increase it as her sister did. So the big savings come from the people who get the message that they're using more than average. But yes, that there are cases like that, and I don't see any practical way to avoid that, but on balance, the program's doing what it intends to.
Well, you know, as we speak, the Oregon legislature is facing a potential walkout from Republicans as they faced last year when they tried to tax carbon emissions. The big protest planned for the day after we're talking here. And the argument often is not only that it will hurt people of modest means, but also the case that, you know, in Oregon, we're so small, our emissions don't matter. How do you address that in the minute we have left?
Policy is contagion, just like everything else is contagion. The cities that have adopted congestion fees, those were considered extremely controversial. Once New York finally said it was going to implement one, then there are five other cities in the U.S. that have moved that to the top of their agenda, showing that it can work. I don't know if the Oregon measure is revenue neutral. Have they proposed it in that form? If they haven't, they should. If you could implement it and show that it works, you'd be affecting not just what you do in Oregon, but what others do when they see the example that you've set there.
All right. Well, there's a lot to take in the book, and then it's really worth a read, though, to get a look at the ways in which we might be able to harness the things that we sort of unconsciously take as peer pressure now and turn it into something good for all of us. The book is called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. It is the creation of Robert Frank, professor of management and professor of economics at Cornell University. Robert, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jeff. Good to talk with you.
Same here. Take care.